This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Snow sows confusion over town meeting elections. The head of New Hampshire's Child Protection Agency has shown the door for directing workers to close 1,500 cases of suspected child abuse last year. Governor Sununu says no thanks to the GOP plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, and lots of action at the State House. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning. Why don't we start with town meeting? Lots of confusion. Obviously, many towns canceled voting. Other towns stayed the course and voted in the storm. Everyone saw this snow coming. The laws governing town meetings aren't new. Why the confusion, Dean?
I think in part because this is such an unusual event to have such a major blizzard that really shut down roads and a lot of communities for the most part. It was just something that in practice we have not really had to deal with. And, you know, there were kind of mixed signals coming from state government about whether or not towns needed to go forward with their meetings. I think there was some concern about the potential for, you know, voter suppression or some other sort of potential lawsuits if people did not have the option to vote. There was some suggestion that if you were going to postpone, you needed to have somebody there so that people could vote absentee. And there's also, some sort of legal distinction between having a town meeting versus actually voting. So each town does it a little bit differently. The law is kind of vague. We've never had this, or not in my memory anyway, this kind of a weather-related event.
Well, not in yours, nor in Bill Gardner, who's fairly rigid about these things. So why don't we take a listen to what his deputy, David Scanlon, said about their understanding of laws governing town meeting elections.
The position from this office is that RSA 669:1, which is in the section of the statute that talks about town elections, says very clearly that the town election shall be held on the second Tuesday in March. From our perspective, there's no provision that allows for the actual date of the actual statutory date of the election officers to be moved. And we cannot recall it ever happening for weather or any other reason.
All right. That was Deputy Secretary of State David Scanlon speaking with NH1. And, you know, he cited one statute. The people on the other side of this issue, the local officials, were citing another, which is Chapter 40:4, which says, in the event of a weather emergency in which the moderator reasonably believes may cause the roads to be hazardous or unsafe, the moderator may postpone and reschedule the deliberative session or voting day of a meeting to another reasonable date, place, and time certain. So that's another statute. And, you know, in the middle of this was Governor Sununu. Why don't we take a listen to what the advice he gave cities and towns on the eve of the election?
There is some differing opinion at the state level as to whether that is a valid process for them to take. Given that there are differing opinions, the best we can do is to strongly recommend that all towns stay open for voting tomorrow. We think that's a very important part of the process.
All right, Allie, that was the governor. What do you make of the way that this was handled?
You know, I think given that there were weather reports over the weekend, that the snow was coming, you know, everyone knows, obviously, it's laid out in state law when town elections are. I think some of this guidance came a little bit late from the governor's office and the secretary of state. You know, we were reporting Monday morning that town moderators had already made the decision to postpone their election. They were putting up signs all over town. They were calling people. And a couple hours later, the secretary of state's office and the governor came out, urged people to continue holding their elections. And, I think that kind of fed into some of the confusion about, you know, are people voting tomorrow? Are they not? What should proceed? And, given that there was a storm, I just think it was a perfect storm of confusion.
That's a good point. It really did feel like they were sort of figuring it out at the last minute. And I think, you know, New Hampshire, as we know, has one of the oldest mean in ages in the country. There are a lot of retirees up here, don't particularly like going out in bad conditions. This was sort of a classic example of that. So I think you're right. We would have expected that they might have sorted this out a little bit more frequently. But Josh, even just listening to you laying out these sort of conflicting statutes, you can see where the problem is.
Right. And I think what some of the Secretary of State's point was, you know, if we had the presidential primary on a snow day, we wouldn't postpone that. People would still go. And so I think their point was the expectation is always it comes on the second Tuesday of March. And if people may not be reading newspapers, if they're not seeing that it's postponed, they may show up to the polls trying to vote. And what will they do? Will their vote not be counted? And so Chris Sununu had recommended that they give out absentee ballots, but then that creates some confusion about can absentee ballots be counted, because the way the law is written, absentee ballots hinge on the second Tuesday in March. And so I think going forward, we'll see whether any of this causes issues or people may challenge election outcomes based on some of this.
Well, the governor had said that towns that went ahead, that choose to reschedule and didn't go ahead, would do so at their own risk, at least raising the specter of potential legal challenges to, you know, somebody who believed they were adversely affected by the outcome of an election. And in some towns, you know, in Bedford, there was a town councilor who tried to get a court to force the town to vote despite the snow. That failed. And, you know, there was quick action at the State House. You know, Democrats have introduced language that they're going to put in a bill that would make sure that results from Tuesday could withstand legal challenge. Why don't we listen to what Senate Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn had to say on that? He's the lead author of that bill.
And it's aimed only to ensure those places, those voters who are in those communities where their elections were moved, that those results would be honored. I fully expect that we will, through the legislative process, tighten up this question. We have some time to do it, to try to have some better clarity as to where this authority lies, either in the local communities, or will it be in the state.
All right, that was Senate Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn talking about a bill that he's introduced that would affirm results in towns that did not choose to vote on Tuesday. So, you know, more to come on that issue, and we will see. But in terms of the results, I mean, did either of you see anything telling that came out of the towns that did vote on Tuesday?
Not in particular. No, I will say that, you know, from kind of monitoring television during the storm, there were some towns that had went ahead and had seemed to have pretty good turnout. And I think everybody, I mean, I think there is an understanding that this is just something we haven't had to deal with, and that it needs to be, you know, that you want to, as Senator Woodburn said, you want to kind of protect the towns that postponed due to weather, given the conflicting statutes. But it is something that I think now they'll have a better chance of sort of figuring out for the future should this happen again.
I mean, certainly it was a mishmash in terms of my scanning of what happened. You know, there was a long debated school building project in Newmarket that went forward. It had been rejected several times before, $39 million to renovate and build additions onto elementary and junior and senior high school there. There were some towns that voted down projects. Like, I didn't see anything that suggested a clear mood on spending.
And those are the kinds of things you often encounter at these meetings. You know, a new public safety building, renovations to a school, et cetera. Those kinds of big projects that may come up year after year. And so the interesting question would be whether the weather had an impact on, you know, in one way or the other. You assume the impact would be sort of random in terms of who shows up and who doesn't.
Well, I mean, the people who are more avid,
obviously
either in favor or against something, are going
to
turn out. And certainly I was scanning the voter totals in towns, and they didn't seem to be dramatically down. And certainly that was the argument that Secretary of State Gardner made about, you know, he told this sort of long anecdote about a blizzard in the 80s on election day, and that he looked out the window, he didn't think anyone was going to vote, but it ended up that tons of people did vote, and that's why we should have it. Well, why don't you tell us what you think? The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliota, Southern Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor. And now why don't we go to the phones? Peggy is on the line from Center Harbor. Good morning, Peggy. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm just calling with a comment, a disturbing comment. The day before, I believe the day before the election, there was an article in the Laconia Daily Sun in which Norman Silber, who, and I don't live in Guilford, but this kind of attitude disturbs me, Mr. Silber is on the Guilford Budget Committee, and he is a big proponent of not passing the school budget as prepared by the school board. And he stated in this article in The Sun that he was very, very happy that the weather was going to be bad and the schools were going to be closed because that would keep parents from being able to go out and vote. And assuming that parents would vote for the school budget. And so he was happy about that because it would prevent people from voting.
Well, Mr. Silber's he's a state rep as well. I mean, it's a very frank statement. Obviously, he had a political hope, and just to be clear, so did voting take place
in Guilford?
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But he said he was happy that the weather was going to be bad because it would prevent some people from voting, and this kind of an attitude to me is extremely disturbing.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. I mean, you certainly, election results are made by the people who show up to vote. And, depending on your point of view, turnout high or low can be a good or bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it'll be interesting, too, when it comes to school districts. One of the most noteworthy points of confusion out of this postponing voting debacle is for these multi-town school districts. So there's a couple where, four towns pool their students and send them to one high school. And there were cases where two of the towns would voted on Tuesday, two postponed, one released their election results. And, then it sort of questions, what's the integrity of this election and can this be fair and go forward?
Particularly if some people are seeing results in advance of actually voting, that can be problematic.
Mm-hmm. And it will be interesting to see whether or not the legal protection, Senator Woodburn and others hope may be found in this legislation, how that might actually stand up if it were challenged. That's a decision for down the road, of course. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Again, this week, Dean Spiliotto, Southern New Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor. I want to turn to a story that Allie reported recently that caused a bit of a stir when it was revealed that DCYF, under the direction of Lorraine Bartlett, had instructed workers to more or less abruptly close 1,500 cases of suspected abuse last year. Why don't you take it from here, Allie? First off, how did you learn about this story, which I know that involves some FOIAs?
Yeah, definitely. I think most people know, the Division for Children, Youth, and Families oversees abuse and neglect investigations. They've been under scrutiny over the last 2 years after two toddlers under their supervision were both killed within a year of each other. And they underwent a review by an outside agency. And I had heard that they had been closing a number of cases, either leading up to the review or after the review. And so I filed a right-to-know request, just seeking information about that. And what I found is that over 2 days in February in 2016, more than 1,500 open abuse and neglect investigations were closed, and which is quite a big number. That represents about 15% of the investigations that DCYF would have in any 1 year. And this was done to try to reduce a backlog. DCYF, this review found, is very understaffed, doesn't have enough people to keep up with reports of abuse and neglect. And so a lot of times caseworkers just have a lot of open investigations on their plate because they can't keep up. And so this was an effort by supervisors to try to close some of those. And through that process, they suspended some normal procedures that they would follow, such as they didn't send any letters to parents to let them know that the investigation had been closed. They didn't put all of their interviews and information into the statewide system, which is used basically to track people's case. And say a caseworker were to look back on that family, they might not be able to see the full picture of a prior complaint. And so we reported this on Sunday. And on Monday, Governor Sununu and Commissioner Myers decided to put the head of DCYF on administrative leave. She was already set to retire on April 1st, so she's leaving a bit earlier than planned. And they are going to potentially hire outside counsel to look at what went wrong here or review those 1,500 cases and see if any should be reopened.
Well, one thing that was unclear to me, and perhaps you can clarify, is the timing on this. My recollection is this outside review was announced sometime in the fall of 2015, but its scope wasn't entirely clear at the time when this premature closure of cases would have been taking place. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it Governor Hassan announced this review in October, and a couple months later in February was when this mass closure happened. And at that point, I believe the Executive Council was approving money to move forward on this audit, although the exact parameters of what would be happening weren't entirely clear at that point.
Yeah, they were raising questions about whether or not there would be review of the cases of Breel Gage and Sadie Willow, the girls who family had been under the supervision of DCOF who had both died, mm-hmm. or whether this was going to be kind of an audit where random cases would be selected.
Exactly, yep. And it ended up being the latter.
And the bottom line from the state, Jeff Myers, Health and Human Services Commissioner, said, quote, the closure of these cases was not undertaken consistent with best practices or in accordance with established policies. And, you know, this news broke as Senate lawmakers were considering a reorganization bill in the Senate. That bill passed by voice vote yesterday. What strikes you as most telling about what the Senate did, Allie?
Well, I think the biggest part of that bill they passed is the so-called Office of a Child Advocate, who would basically be established, a pretty powerful one, would have subpoena power and would be able to review what DCYF does to provide some consistent outside oversight at the agency. And I think that's what a lot of lawmakers say they want. Because this agency deals with children and obviously sensitive matter like abuse and neglect, most of their records are not public. You can't find out what happens in family court. You can't find out what happens in all of these cases. And so what they hope this office would do is shine some light on that by keeping, appropriate confidentiality, but also making sure that the agency is doing its job.
And they're also replacing the DCYF director with a new associate commissioner of HHS. the idea here is to have have an opportunity for more oversight. There had been some discussion about maybe pulling DCYF out of HHS completely, but for reasons of cost and efficiency, they decided it made more sense to keep it in the department and also give Secretary Myers an opportunity to see how reorganization might work. But, this has all kind of been coming to a head for some time now, and Allie's reporting, I think, just sort of helped to accelerate the idea that something pretty dramatic needed to be done here.
But the Senate did kill a separate bill yesterday that would have added more caseworkers, which was recommended in that outside review.
Right.
Of course, that discussion is going to continue.
Well, and I think that will be the most noteworthy thing to watch. What this review said is effectively you can't make change unless you hire the people you need to staff up this agency. And yes, the Senate did table a bill yesterday to add more people. That's currently in the budget. Governor Sununu has provided more money.
So the idea is that it'll happen eventually, but the money will come through the budget? Are they just sort of postponing the discussion of that?
That's Chris Sununu's goal, I believe, but it still has to go through the House and the Senate. And so, this money isn't a sure thing like a bill to provide these additional workers would maybe be.
And certainly one of the principles that the governor said was important to him in his budget considerations throughout the process as he proposed it and as the debate continues is, essentially looking out for children, whether that be under the purview of DCYF, whether that be in terms of education opportunities. That was one of the things he said he was going to be focused on. Tell us what you think. Again, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back after a short break.
Looking for a good read or want to learn how to write one, NHPR's podcasts have got you covered.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about those moments and how you saw them fitting into the book.
Well, I don't think it's...
Do you edit as you're going along or do you tend to write it all out and then go back and edit at the end?
At the very beginning when I started...
Subscribe to The Bookshelf, 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, and all NHPR's podcasts on iTunes and Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. email exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook or Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor. You know, we're talking about the determinations that lawmakers make in a budget year about what bills you may consider in a standalone fashion, what gets larded into the budget. You know, the Senate got moving on a bill to add state troopers this week. That's a policy that's also contemplated in the budget. The same goes for money for infrastructure, also an issue that Governor Sununu proposed in his budget, but looks, you know, touch and go, I think, at least as he conceived it in the House right now. You know, it would seem, Allie, that the governor is, you know, getting together a little bit with the Senate, or the Senate is signaling some of its priorities long before the House makes its final budget decisions.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, House budget writers haven't made any firm decisions yet on how they want to revise the budget. But I have spoken to a few who are skeptical about Governor Sununu's plan to fund full-day kindergarten and his plan for this infrastructure revitalization fund, which some of them are equating to essentially a slush fund that is inappropriate for a governor to have. And what this fund would do is it would set up a commission to oversee a pot of money that could go to anything from bridge aid to school building aid. And I believe the language even basically leaves the door open for a number of different things. And I think House members at this point are sort of telling me it's the legislature's job to pick the priorities that we fund, and it's the governor's job to manage the budget, not to get a pot of money that he can do with whatever he wants while other agencies may be doing the same thing.
I mean, that's certainly a message I've been hearing from them as well. And I know we both sat in a Division II in the House Finance Committee where some of this discussion has been going on. You know, the Senate's infrastructure move this week does come with a little bit more focus than what the governor proposed and a little less money. You know, it is going to be interesting to see where they go. And also on kindergarten, I mean, the Senate has passed a kindergarten bill, which they laid on the table, which was a more traditional, you know, kind of full freight per pupil, everybody gets some plan rather than what the governor proposed, which was a targeted plan. Again, you know, the Senate tends to have the advantage of more money due to later revenue estimates than the House has. I mean, the House's revenue estimates were $60 million less than the governor's. The House also has eyed some infirmities, I guess you could call them, in the governor's plan that may require, you know, more action. And with Republicans in control, new taxes are certainly off the table in both House and Senate. But it is interesting to hear in the committee level in the House discussion of ways to slot some revenue in there. Not huge bolts of revenue, but things related to Keno. There's talk of some kind of smartphone way to buy lottery tickets that the Lottery Commission is working on that we may end up seeing in the House's budget proposal. The Senate side, meanwhile, they, you know, passed a gambling bill yesterday, and so I don't know whether we're on set for another kind of collision course.
Yeah, this is another Lou D'Alessandro bill to legalize two casinos in New Hampshire, and you know he has said this is something he's supported for years. He again noted that charitable gaming in New Hampshire brings in between $100 to $200 million a year, but state and communities don't really have access to that revenue. So you know, this may be another go around of gambling as a funding source.
Okay, so we're joined now by New Hampshire Public Radio News Director Dan Barrick. Dan, you've spent a lot of time observing the budget process, scrutinizing how the process plays out in the House and Senate. You know, now the House is trying to sort of cobble together a plan that essentially they, you know, heave over to the Senate. The Senate is, you know, already, you know, making budget moves itself. You know, in one of these division meetings I was attending this week, I heard one member say, you know, this boat doesn't need to float for long. We need to get it over to the Senate. They will have opportunities for revenue we don't have. Why is that?
Well, it's a result of a number of things. One, it's just the calendar, the timing. The House, just because of the way the legislative calendar set up, has several weeks less time to tighten all the bolts on their budget. So that means, you know, a lot of the more details that you might ideally get to just kind of have to be, as you said, kind of airbrushed in. The other is, you know, so much of the budget conversation is based around how much money are we as a state going to have 18 months from now? You know, when you're, or actually more than that, you know, when you look at to the end of the 2-year budget cycle. So they've got less clarity in terms of revenue forecasts, how are business taxes going to do, how's the real estate market going to look like in 2 years. So especially when you have a Republican leadership, they tend to be much more conservative, just sort of not politically conservative, but, you know, sort of just by temperament in how they assess those revenues. And you've got, you know, if you look at just the makeup, the real key players in both the House and the Senate and in the finance committees, Chuck Morse over in the Senate, Neil Kirk in the House, and even the Democrats on both sides, you know, Lou D'Alessandro and Marjorie Smith and Dan Eaton. You got some people who've been there for a really long, I mean, between that handful, they probably
got
decades of budget writing experience there. So there's a lot of shortcuts that they've sort of accumulated over the years. But you're right. I mean, it's not uncommon practice for the House to kind of do this last minute scramble, just get some to the Senate that they can work with, and then obviously the week or 2 week long committee of conference season, you know, at the end of June is really where you get that final product.
The revenue estimates are just a lot better by the time you get to May or June, and the spring is often a time of enhanced receipts for the state anyway, so it's always been that the Senate is really the moment at which we have a better idea of how much revenue is going to be available.
I mean, we are a long way off, and the Committee of Conference is something kind of we're all looking forward to already. But the last few budget cycles, it has seemed as if the Senate institutionally, has certain advantages. One is the calendar. You've got fewer people. In Senate President Morse, you have somebody whose real area of expertise is the budget, who has played a strong hand in it, either writing it or kind of ghostwriting it for the Senate. And so, you know, we'll see where that goes. And, you know, Governor Sununu hasn't, come out of the blocks as a fantastic operator in terms of dealing with the legislature, at least publicly. But he and Senator Morse seem to have a reasonable relationship. And, you know, there were signals from Senator Morse this week on this infrastructure package in the Senate that he had been working with the governor, that he had talked about it, and that they were in agreement. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, and I think what we're seeing is that Republicans now control the Senate House and the corner office. And I don't think that Senate leaders and, you know, Senate President Chuck Morse necessarily want to see Chris Sununu flop on his first budget. And so I think, they don't want headlines like the right to work headlines, which was, you know, Republican infighting. So I think what we're seeing with this budget process is sort of treating some of his proposals gingerly, where, you know, maybe they keep the infrastructure revitalization fund, but don't give it much money to try to take the edge off some of these potential defeats.
And, I mean, you could look at some of those. I mean, we've talked about those in past weeks about, you know, what are the kind of signature, what were the headlines coming out of the governor's budget proposal? And there were a few clear things that he'd identified, you know, the full-day kindergarten, this infrastructure fund, additional state troopers. One could say that, you know, on the one hand, those are areas where, especially in the Senate, as you said, Josh, seem to be getting a little bit more attention from leadership there. On the one hand, those are policy proposals that address real needs or concerns, you know, the built environment around the state, early childhood education, the drug crisis. On the other hand, if the governor manages, if at least two out of those three make their way through the budget, those are pretty good political talking points. He could claim to be the governor to bring full day kindergarten to New Hampshire. He could be the governor to have finally addressed the state's infrastructure crisis. He could be the governor to beef up law enforcement on the. So I think there
sounds like quite a guy.
Yeah. Well, I think as Ali said, you know, there's sort of the party politics at play here that Republican leadership in the legislature want to within reason and not cede control to the governor to give him a boost on some things that'll give him some steam coming out of this biennium.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dan Barrick of NHPR, Ali Morris, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You know, Dan, what you say is true about kind of a team effort, and the political benefits of that potentially for all involved regarding the budget. So slightly more fraught patch for the governor to navigate will be regarding the Republican health care bill now pending in Washington. For weeks, the governor has been saying he's optimistic about what's going to happen in Washington, that he believes there'll be flexibility is a word he likes to use a lot. He's kind of slowly edged his way into the pool of saying, like, you know, he's not so wild about this plan pending in Congress now that he knows what's in it. Why don't we take a listen to what he said this week?
What I'm seeing in Washington gives me a lot of pause for concern, to be sure, not just on the Medicaid expansion front, because that would drastically affect New Hampshire, but just on the mandates that are coming out of it. So definitely not a bill I'm signing on to.
That was Governor Sununu earlier this week talking about the GOP Affordable Care Act replacement pending in Washington. You know, how much does it matter what he says about this, Allie?
I guess it remains to be seen. There was a report that he did speak with the Federal Health and Human Services Director, Tom Price. And a brief readout that I got from the office about that call is he expressed that he would like to be able to have work requirements for people in expanded Medicaid, which was a big push from Republicans. But otherwise, I'm not sure. He hasn't really come out of the gates as a big proponent or opponent one way or the other. I don't think he's become a national voice on this issue. But it is one that definitely affects New Hampshire.
But it definitely, in my mind, it definitely reflects a change in his tone. I mean, I remember listening to him and interviewing him a number of weeks ago, and he expressed a fair bit of optimism about the idea of having Medicaid block granted, and it would allow him to sort of more efficiently tailor the Medicaid provision of benefits for New Hampshire. But now we've seen the particulars of the Trump and Ryan plan, and we're looking at about an $880 billion, almost $1 trillion cut in Medicaid funding over 10 years. It would phase out in either 2020 or 2018, depending on what the final version is. And then the reimbursements would drop way down from what it currently is under Medicaid expansion. And I think you start to attach numbers of people losing insurance, given we have, 50,000 plus here in New Hampshire. I think we've heard this change in tone based on the reality of the program. But I do recall him being fairly optimistic about block granting and changing Medicaid, et cetera.
I mean, that was never tethered to anything terribly specific.
No,
I mean,
but just in general, like, his sort of conceptually.
Flexibility, right? And allows to create pathways is another word he likes to use a lot.
Yeah, but the reality of it, I think, is setting in.
But and don't forget, I mean, the Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire was a Republican plan. It was a plan largely crafted.
Business-friendly plan, supposedly.
Right, largely crafted by the Republican Senate. Those folks are still in the legislature, and they have a lot, they haven't said much, and they've said nothing to indicate that they're willing to roll back that or open to changes. But that's a fact.
Yes, this has been a topic. Obviously, the U.S. Senate is where we're really expecting this bill to potentially be reworked, come unglued. It's going to be a tough debate. There, various Republican senators have come out against it. Certainly, New Hampshire's two Democratic senators have been, very vocal in their opposition. They've been holding, press conferences. They went to Concord Hospital this week. And Senator Hassan now, in her office, kind of breathlessly and repeatedly billed as her maiden Senate floor speech to members of the media, had this to say this week.
Make no mistake. This legislation would end Medicaid expansion, which experts have said is the most important tool available to fight the substance use crisis. This plan also cuts and caps the traditional Medicaid program, which means that states will be forced to either raise taxes or cut eligibility and services. As a former governor, I know full well the impact that decisions in Washington can have on our communities. Repealing Medicaid expansion and capping traditional Medicaid would severely hurt the ability of those on the front lines to save lives and combat this deadly epidemic.
That was Senator Maggie Hassan this week in her first floor speech as a member of the Senate, making it pretty plain where she stands on this GOP health bill. And, she mentioned opioids, she mentioned Medicaid expansion. Dan, you mentioned that the plan that we have in New Hampshire on Medicaid expansion was largely a product of Republican thinking. Are we hearing anything about, obviously it's going to be, there's some time for New Hampshire to act, presuming an absence of quick action in Washington. I mean, does anyone know what the current thinking is among, Republicans in the state Senate, for instance, about how to navigate this? I mean, they've been pretty quiet.
Pretty quiet. I think, as you said, it's really waiting to see. I mean, there's real political risk at this point in coming out and policy risk in coming out and endorsing, any plan that's in Washington now, and the response, and again, largely it's been the inner party politics of Republicans on Capitol Hill that's been churning here. Trying to understand where that's going in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate has been so opaque from the outside. I don't think there's any interest in Concord and really trying to forecast what that would look like in New Hampshire.
And you're seeing that play out on the national level as well. There are Republicans in the U.S. Congress who are you know, if in fact this is going to change dramatically from the House when it moves to the U.S. Senate, you know, there are some Republicans in the Senate telling their colleagues in the House, you don't really want to vote for this in the current form because that will come back to haunt you, particularly if you're in a Medicaid expansion state and have to run for re-election, and you know, which obviously all members of the House of Representatives do every 2 years. So this is sort of a multi-leveled strategic electoral game based on the impact on Medicaid and whether or not you accept the numbers coming out of the Congressional Budget Office in terms of loss of coverage. You look over at the U.S. Senate and it's going to be tough. You got conservatives in the Senate like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton and others who want to move up the Medicaid expansion phase out date to 2018. And then you have others like Susan Collins, Republican Rob Portman. Ohio is a Medicaid expansion state. We've heard John Kasich talk about that many times, the governor, wanting to move in the opposite direction. So this is a long way from over, and it just doesn't seem like it makes sense for a lot of these individuals who have to stand for re-election to make a definitive statement.
Well, it's interesting to hear Governor Sununu saying that he plans to work with, our delegation and the Trump administration. As of early in the week at this event at Concord Hospital, I covered where Senators Hassan and Shaheen were, pillorying this bill, more or less. I asked, had they reached out to Governor Sununu? And this is before he had made his statement. And Senator Shaheen had said that, they had a meeting scheduled. It had been postponed, but they were hoping to get together soon. It'll be interesting to see whether everyone's just kind of at arm's length or there is kind of a one voice across party within our New Hampshire officials.
Mm-hmm. And we saw some hesitation this week in the state Senate, too. There was a bill that they tabled that would have expanded Medicaid for 2 more years to 2020. And I spoke to Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, who was a big architect of the state's Medicaid expansion. And he said, it's just too premature to know what we're going to do. Our plan relies mostly on almost entirely on federal dollars, which under this plan will be phased out. And the state has taken an approach that, or at least Republicans have, that they don't want taxpayers to have to fund this.
And did this bill contemplate a continuation of the voluntary mm-hmm. contributions by hospitals and insurers to make up the absence of federal money?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been laid on the table?
Yes.
There are a lot of things finding themselves on the table these days.
It's a big table.
it's an infinite table. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange. Could be the Obamacare repeal bill. Could be action at the State House. Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Again, this week, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, Dan Barrick from right here at NHPR. And, I want to turn, in a minute, we'll step, out of the legislative arena in the State House. But as far as what we're seeing in the near term in terms of the budget, we're coming up on the break. We'll be back in a moment.
Looking for a good read or want to learn how to write one? NHPR's podcasts have got you covered.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about those moments and how you saw them fitting into the book.
Well, I don't think it's...
Do you edit as you're going along, or do you tend to write it all out and then go back and edit at the end?
At the very beginning, when I started...
Subscribe to The Bookshelf, 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, and all NHPR's podcasts on iTunes and Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and of course on Twitter, joined this week by Ali Morris, Concord Monitor, Dan Barrett from here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we go to the phones? Dan is on the line from Nashua. Good morning, Dan. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning. When the Medicaid expansion was being contemplated by the up and Concord by the Senate and the House, the arguments by the Republicans were that we don't want to make it permanent because the federal government might cut support. And so that was sort of the bargain that the Republicans made. And so now that the federal government is looking to cut support, I am almost appalled that the Republicans are considering continuing expanded Medicaid. Don't you think that would be going against the original position?
Good question, Dan. You know, that was something of risk. You know, it's very – you talk to even the most hawkish fiscal types, and they will tell you that taking away a benefit or a service once granted is a political challenge. I mean, you know, obviously the Republicans were hoping to have leverage over the process, and you know, depending on what comes out of Washington, you know, we shall see, Dan.
No, I mean you Dan on the phone is exactly right. You heard lots of conservative warning of that, which seemed kind of, you know, in the heady days of, you know, right after Obamacare had just passed Congress, Democrats especially felt very eager to implement this on the state level. But he's absolutely right. This is sort of the scenario that may come to pass. Politicians like getting reelected. It's hard to get reelected when you take away a benefit to, you know, a large chunk of the population. I think that may well be where we find ourselves.
Well, the flip side of that was the millions of dollars that those on the other side were saying we're going to sort of pour into the state, get into the healthcare system. You know, they argued that you'd have more people on the insurance rolls, which would lower other costs within the system.
That's why the business, you know, BIA and other businesses support it, hospitals. So,
well, and Dan, I think that's why they're hitting the brakes on it now, is that it's unclear whether the federal government will cut off money, which in which case I'm sure representatives will reevaluate the program, which I believe costs $400 million, I think, is what the federal government is kicking in right now, which is a big cost for the state to just suddenly pick up. So I think that's why conversations around this have sort of stalled.
Yeah, it's a classic unfunded mandate. Even beyond that, it's not even the federal government saying you need to provide this benefit that we've set up through the state, but you're just basically going to need to figure out how to deal with a dramatic cut, if this goes through, a dramatic cut in funding over time. Now, you know, Republicans have argued, and I've heard the Health and Human Services Secretary Price argue that there will be access for health care for people who would qualify for Medicaid, but I think there's real concern about how you would administer a program with that kind of a cut in federal funding.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. I want to turn to another story that was in the news this week, an interesting one involving Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue. He was in the news for a story involving an anonymous contribution he made to the legal fund for the Croydon School Board, which is in a legal fight with the state, with the Department of Education that Frank Edelblue now leads, over its decision to send some students, a few of them, to a Montessori school using tax dollars. Obviously, it's no secret that Frank Edelblue supports school choice. It was a key plank in his campaign for governor. It's been, you know, aired a great deal since. And it appears he made this contribution, $1,000, well before his job was on the horizon. So, you know, does this strike you folks as that this story is significant in its substance or mostly interesting because of how Edelblue handled the inquiry, which originally came from the Valley News? Allie?
Sure. I think it's the latter. I mean, the Valley News, this all kind of came up when the Valley News reported earlier this week that the school board wouldn't reveal who some of its anonymous donors are, who made up more than half of the $23,000 they'd raised for this legal fund. So the Valley News went around asking, you know, key players who may have donated. And when they asked Frank Edelblue, who is the new education commissioner, he denied multiple requests for them to give them an answer, even once in person when they showed up at an event where he was speaking. Another time they showed up to the Department of Education and were not allowed inside. And so I think that lead up kind of set the stage for when he did admit to giving this money. There were calls from executive counselors who basically said, why didn't you tell us this beforehand? Why didn't you tell the Valley News? It's a transparency issue.
Well, why don't we listen to some tape? I talked to Commissioner Edelblue yesterday on this.
Why did you not want to disclose it when people asked you?
Well, as soon as Andrew Valinsky asked me to disclose it, I sent him an email with all the information.
But when reporters asked you?
Because that information was information that would be available to the from the school board, not from me, no.
So do you consider this an impediment to
no.
your service going forward?
No. Focused on the mission.
All right. That was Commissioner Attleblue yesterday. I was talking to him at the State House, focused on the mission. You know, it's interesting, though, that he did stonewall pretty aggressively, including, according to the Valley News article, when the Center reported the Department of Education, somebody who worked at the Department of Education, who was identified only as Skip, in quotation marks, you know, essentially told this reporter, you know, get lost or we're going to call security.
And that's the only, I mean, this is the only part of this whole story that that seems odd to me. It's not at all unusual that Frank Attleblue would support the Corinne School Board here. He's made very clear he's an avowed proponent of school choice. It's not unusual that he would have given the money. He's a wealthy guy. It's not even unusual, I don't think, that he would have done it anonymously. A lot of times these legal defense funds are that way. I don't even think it's that unusual that it didn't come up during his confirmation hearings. Nobody asked him point blank. And,
it was six months earlier.
Yeah. And, you know, for him, a relatively small amount of money. He's a wealthy guy. I imagine he makes many charitable contributions. The only thing that's odd to me is that he appears to have thought that he could just by refusing to answer reporters' questions, make this go away. And I think if he had just, if the original story had just been he was among the donors. That said, I don't think there's going to be any. It's consistent with his policy views. It's an issue that's actually quite it's moot right now. The lawsuit's on hold pending legislation that seems
set to
go through the legislature and signed by the governor. That would essentially eliminate the need for this suit. It would allow things, you know, cases where if school districts want to use public money to send students to private schools if there's no public school in that district. It's just the process. And I think, if anything, it just speaks to perhaps a learning curve for the commissioner. He's new to government. Other than a single term as a state rep, he's never held any public office before. He has not shown himself to be terribly available to the media. I mean, I know reporters have recounted that sometimes you ask him a question, he'll just turn his back and walk away. That this part of the role, the transparency, the public accountability, may be one that he's going to have to get up to speed on.
The actual donation and support and all that's completely unsurprising to me. But I would have used the same word. It's just a little odd. I think, you know, maybe it is a learning curve. I think the only concern going forward would be kind of a full understanding of the nature of transparency required by the job. And you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But it just sort of is an odd moment.
Well, Allie, you and I were both in the Finance Committee when Commissioner Attleblue testified yesterday during a work session. And, you know, he was a member of that committee, and he certainly seemed to acquit himself well, and, you know, clearly has a rapport with some of his former colleagues. I did think it was interesting that some of the requests that he made that he was hoping to get for his department, including, you know, a new website, which, you know, you could argue is necessary to better serve, in his terms, the consumer. You know, I thought it was somewhat funny when he said he also wants a communications person, perhaps somebody with a smoother edge than Skip, to handle inquiries for the media. You know, he is, a lot of people didn't understand that after his very high-profile confirmation hearing, that he was confirmed for the remainder of his predecessor Virginia Berry's term. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, he needs to be voted on again, and that vote could come as soon as next week. You know, it'll be interesting to see what Counselor Valinsky, if he chooses to make a big deal of this again. I mean, he's brought, obviously, before he became an executive counselor, perhaps best known as the lead attorney in the Claremont lawsuit. He really took it to Attleblue throughout this process. And, you know, I thought it was interesting when I asked him, why didn't you respond? He said, well, I did respond when Counselor Valinsky essentially asked for the information. And I think we're seeing, you know, Andrew Valinsky, you know, sort of comport himself on the council in a way that is different than a lot of his predecessors have. I mean, a much more aggressive approach towards getting answers. And, you know, he weighed in on this Croydon Legal Defense Fund, saying he's an attorney, said that he believes that, you know, Croydon has said that it doesn't have to give up this information. The Valley News has challenged under the right to know, as has the New Hampshire Union Leader. You know, Valinsky is right out there saying, you know, he doesn't believe Croydon has a leg to stand on. Do we think we're going to see Valinsky?
Well, I mean, the politics of it, you know, with unified Republican majorities in the House and Senate, and the council is really the only place in which, I mean, Democrats are in a minority there too, but if you just physically just in terms of sheer geography,
being a face-to-face,
it's the one place where Democrats can get nose-to-nose with the governor on a regular basis. And as you said, Councillor Walensky, given his background as a trial attorney and just his demeanor and his stated goal for how he sees the role of executive counselor, seems eager to use that in sort of a prosecutorial role, whether it's with appointments by Governor Sununu or the governor himself. And I think he's one of the most interesting people to keep your eye on, I think, the next 2 years in Concord in terms of how he might use that platform both for his party and for himself.
So, Ali, when you were reporting on the Edelbluth, did you talk to any councillors other than, I mean, when you said councillors were curious as to why this didn't come up, I mean, is there any sense that Republicans have any concern about any of this, or?
I don't think so. I mean, as you know, it has been stated, this doesn't stray from where Commissioner Edelbluth stands on the issue. It's not like he made an anonymous donation to something that's in direct contrast to his position. I mean, he's been a very vocal supporter of what the Croydon School Board is doing. He even, when he was in the House, he sponsored the bill that would make this legal, effectively, which is now making its way through the legislature again and seems poised to pass. So I think as for whether this will sway the three Republicans who voted him in as commissioner, I really don't think so. I mean, they passed him on these merits before.
It was interesting when he was confirmed. I mean, certainly Councillor Russell Prescott, a Republican, said, you know, one of the questions he put to Frank Edelbluth was, you know, essentially, are you going to embarrass us? And I don't think this constitutes embarrassment for anybody, but, you know, certainly this was a high-profile appointment. You know, Commissioner Edelbluth, you know, never confirmed that he planned to actually serve out his full term. We could see him back in the electoral arena.
No, that's true. And I think what we did see in the House Finance Committee the other day is he came very prepared. I think the committee members openly said that they were impressed with the information that he was providing. Yes. And so I think, you know, this dust up broke on that very same morning and didn't come up in the committee meeting. And, you know, he won praise from some of the Republicans on the committee. So it doesn't seem like this is something that will oust him.
Mm. And so he may be, you know, someday on the horizon, perhaps back in electoral politics, somebody who has announced an intent to seek office again is Joyce Craig of Manchester. She narrowly lost to Mayor Ted Gatzes in that race. You know, she told NHPR essentially she sees a lot of the issues as the same. And, you know, Democrats see her as a strong option in terms of getting back the mayorship in Manchester after, you know, a pretty long run by Gatzes.
Yeah, you know, if Mayor Gatzes decides to run, it would be for a fifth term. And as you mentioned, the election in 2015, after a recount, Joyce Craig lost only by 64 votes. And as you mentioned, she's already signaled it's going to be kind of a rerun of the previous race, talking about, you know, the Manchester schools, the opioid crisis, crime, a lot of the issues that we've talked about for some time now regarding Manchester. Yeah, I think they see it as an opportunity to take back the mayorship after a long period of time.
And, you know, Republicans are also, you know, signaling interest in challenging Carol Shea Porter in CD1. We have familiar names, you know, obtaining political consultants, Eddie Edwards, former chief of the Enforcement Division at the New Hampshire Liquor Commission, ran for state Senate, has been involved in law enforcement. And, you know, a name we're definitely familiar with covering, Dan, John Steven, former Health and Human Services Commissioner and failed gubernatorial and congressional candidate. He's also making noises about running for that.
I haven't heard his name for a while. I mean, it seemed, you know, back in the early 2000s, he was running pretty much every 2 years for Congress and governor, and I think Congress again. You know, the closest he came was, I think, you know, I don't know, like a
I mean,
six,
he won the
2010. He was the governor.
He came as close as anyone did to ousting John Lynch.
It
was a very favorable year for Republicans. Since then, he's gone off. He started a consulting firm and seems to have done quite well by himself. But, you know, he was clearly, even when he was, you know, Health and Human Services Commissioner, a guy with great appetite for holding political office. And that CD1 seat, I mean, you know, we know that that's tossed back and forth between Democrats and Republicans for the last dozen years. If you're an ambitious Republican looking to hold high office in New Hampshire right now, that's kind of the only option. I mean, CD2 is, you know, is so sort of strongly Democratic.
Not going to be a Senate race for a while.
Not going to be a Senate race for a while. Governor Sununu, you know, is there. So that's it. You know, Frank Ginta, who knows if he'll run again. I wonder if the sort of fuel's out of the tank on that one. But it is interesting, just a few months after the election, you're already seeing some of these ambitious Republicans looking to lock down a corner on that first congressional district race.
All right. It is St. Patrick's Day. I do want to note that according to Bishop Labashi, it is fine for people to eat meat on Lent, you know, in light of the holiday. And before we go, I also want to note the passing of Guy McMillan, longtime editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel, somebody who appeared on this show many times, and you know, somebody of good humor and rigor in the job in Keene for many, many years. Sorry to hear that he died. So we're at the end of the show. Next week, it's a busy time at the State House, Allie. Hard to know which thing to focus on. What are you going to be looking at?
I will be watching the House budget writers are going to start making their first decisions about what they are keeping or cutting from the budget. So I will be watching that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and
every
I believe
day but
Friday.
Thursday. According
yeah.
to Chairman Kirk,
I heard that this morning.
It's going to be a busy week. Dan?
As I mentioned earlier, I don't think there's many political ramifications at stake, or even real substantive policy. But the vote to quote unquote reconfirm Commissioner Ada Blue Wednesday before the Executive Council, just what kind of a platform that might offer, especially Councilor Andy Valinsky, to kind of, you know,
get out there,
bring this stuff back into the light of day.
Dean?
You know, the State House, you can barely keep up with all the developments, but I continue to be fascinated by the interaction between what's going on in Washington, particularly on health care with our congressional delegation and sort of how all that connects into what's going on here with the State House and with Governor Sununu now taking a more negative view of the health care repeal and replace.
All right. And just to note, on the exchange on Monday, there's going to be a discussion of Donald Trump's budget proposal and its ramifications for New Hampshire. In the meantime, have a good weekend. All this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.